Case number 14-7051, Greg Burley, Appellant versus National Passenger Rail Corp., doing business as Amtrak. Mr. Carl for the appellant, Mrs. Sakalakis for the appellate.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Mr. Burley and Mr. Eversoll were subject to the same work rules. This case is about the selective application of those rules. Burley had received a waiver in formal disposition of the charges against him. He wouldn't have been fired. We wouldn't be here. Now, there are two separate narratives in the record of why the locomotive derailed. Amtrak says that the African-American engineer, Mr. Burley, was solely responsible. This is what Pesh said he believed, and based on the documents prepared by Smith and reflecting Smith's testimony and the fact that he concealed the mitigating factors in his report, it certainly would appear that way. But what is not in the record is Eversoll's breach of his duty, the fact that he jumped off a moving locomotive, that it was Eversoll's job as the conductor to run the movement of the locomotive. Burley is driving the locomotive. He believes Eversoll's on the front of the locomotive. When you compare the discipline imposed on the two employees, Eversoll was more experienced. He knew better. He was in charge of the movement of the engine. There were no lights, no blue lights displayed on the track, and Burley couldn't see the derail itself because of the curve. And, of course, he didn't know that Eversoll had jumped ship. Now, Eversoll testified as part of the investigation that was conducted by Amtrak that, in fact, the blue light was not working. And when you consider the fact that Eversoll acted intentionally and Burley did not, the evidence does not support the disparate discipline that was imposed, particularly since Burley had been cleared by radio to go down the tracks. And he can stop his locomotive if and only if he knows that Burley is gone. So Burley is following, that Eversoll is gone. Burley is following directions. Eversoll is off the locomotive. Eversoll starts yelling at him, telling him that the derail is deployed.
Burley have an obligation under his training to know where every blue signal and every derailer is in this area and have anybody who's on a moving, I mean, I thought the rule was anybody who's on a moving train is responsible for it.
He knew where the derail was. He believed that Eversoll was in the front of the locomotive directing his move. Blue light was not displayed, and so there was no reason for Burley to think or believe that the derail was still deployed and would derail his.
This is not in the record, but I found it really bizarre, and when I think about this case, I don't understand why, you know, every new car these days has a video camera showing things that you can't see with your own eyes. They really have to rely on a live human being having to be on the front of the train in order to see where there are these signals or derails?
Yes, Your Honor. And Eversoll was either supposed to be on the train or he was supposed to be on the ground.
He was shouting at him, but he couldn't be heard. I just find it mind-boggling. I mean, no, that's not the issue in this case, but I'm just trying to understand the circumstances. It seems mind-boggling there's such a primitive system.
And part of it is that's the reason why they had two conductors out there. They had a conductor and assistant conductor, because if you look at the map of the railroad yard, you see the curve in the track, so Burley is not able to see.
You're describing a situation that may seem a little random to us. It may not seem the best way to run a railroad, but your burden is to show that there was a tribal issue of discrimination. And I guess the question is, where is there evidence that the reason for this, what might be odd decision, to treat Ebersole differently is in any way attributable to race?
Well, first of all, no one admits or acknowledges being involved in giving Ebersole a waiver, but it appears that decision, and a jury could find that decision was made by Mr. Smith.
What's the evidence in the record that a jury would rely on for that, that Smith was involved in Ebersole's?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What's the evidence in the record that supports the notion that it was Smith who was involved in Ebersole's waiver?
Because the people above him, Sherlock and Pesh, have no recollection, and the record shows that the decision like that is ordinarily made at the assistant superintendent or superintendent level.
Or someone above. That's what he testified to.
Or what's the big part?
This guy, Ingley, is that his name? Is that the guy who testified? Ingley? Do I have
Pingley, yes, Your Honor.
What's his name?
His name is Pingley.
Pingley, yeah, right. He says, you're true, nobody knows what happened in this case, but he says that such decisions would normally be made by the assistant superintendent, quote, or someone above, right? That's what he testified to. Smith was the assistant superintendent, but it could have been someone above Smith who did the...
It could have been accepted neither Pesh nor Sherlock say that they had any involvement in the decision to give a waiver to Ebersole. Uh-huh. And if the decision to give Ebersole was a waiver was made at Smith's level, then it certainly appears likely, given what Smith knew, that he was involved in the decision to deny a waiver to Burley. And when I talk in terms of what mm-hmm. Smith knew that Ebersole stated that the blue light was not deployed. Now, Smith goes to the scene of the derailment and says that the blue light was flashing and that the blue light was properly displayed. This is the particular finding, the testimony, that the Locomotive Engineer Review Board says is not supported by substantial evidence. And with the law of the circuit is that when a decision is not supported by substantial evidence, there's almost nothing there. The courts rarely make that finding. And what Mr. Smith did is he said that the light was deployed even though he was not at the scene of the accident, even though he knew that Ebersole, in this case, had said that the blue light was out. And thirdly, just in terms of the circumstantial evidence, if the locomotive had hit of the blue light that was properly destroyed, the locomotive would have destroyed that blue light. And if you look at what Smith knew about what Ebersole actually did, you look at the charging papers, the notice of the four charges against Ebersole, it's clear that Smith knew that Ebersole dismounted from the locomotive or jumped off the locomotive, and that's the reason why he was not in a position to assist the engineer. And so there are really two separate versions of what happened here. There's the version that Smith spun, that Smith described, in which he omitted critical information, including the reason why Ebersole was not in a position to help Mr. Burley. But secondly, he omitted other mitigating factors, other exculpatory information. So if you look at that first report, Your Honor, it looks like the derailment was solely Burley's fault. But there is other evidence, including the fact that Ebersole said the light wasn't working, including the fact that Ebersole abandoned the ship and left Burley in charge, including the fact that Ebersole didn't tell Burley that he was going to jump off or dismount from the locomotive, that a reasonable jury could find that, well, no, it wasn't solely Burley's fault, that Ebersole was at least as responsible for the derailment as Mr. Burley was, and that was information that, including the mitigating factors that Smith concealed from the people who ultimately reviewed the decision in the report. And when you look at this transcript, for example, of the investigative hearing, well, the Amtrak employees conducting the hearing refuses to hear any claim of disparate discipline. He refuses to consider any of the circumstances that suggested, and we think it certainly strongly suggested, that Ebersole was responsible for the derailment. He refused to allow those matters to be the subject of testimony at the hearing. And so we have a hearing where Mr. Smith has got a report, and what he's essentially doing is reading large portions of the report into the record, including the funny, I thought kind of quaint terminology, Ebersole, the conductor, was not in a position to help Burley. Well, that just begs the question of why he wasn't in a position to help Burley. And the answer to that, and the evidence shows, he wasn't in a position to help Burley because he secretly abandoned ship without telling him.
Is there any rule that requires that conductor to stay on the train?
No, the rule is that you either have to be on the front of the locomotive or you've got to be walking ahead of the locomotive.
And wasn't he walking ahead?
He was walking ahead, but he was walking ahead on Burley's blind side.
Uh-huh.
And his job under the Amtrak and the NORAC rules is that he's got to be in a position where he can
He wasn't disciplined for that, and Amtrak didn't consider him to be out of place in that respect.
Oh, he was out of place. This is what he was charged with.
Being off the train.
But more importantly, not being in a position to help. But this was one of the charges that was subsumed within the waiver, the guilty plea, if you like, to right. which Mr. Ebersole signed off.
Was there evidence other than Burley's interest in a waiver that he did accept responsibility?
He went to his union representative met with Pingley. His union representative met with Sherlock in order to get the waiver, and the answer was, we're not going to talk to you about it.
But they
closed the door.
Was there evidence that he accepted responsibility? I mean, he wanted the benefit of a waiver, but did he sort of in any way say, I messed up, buck stops with me, I'm responsible? Because I think part of the defense argument here is that Ebersole really came forward and accepted responsibility in a way that Burley didn't.
Well, there are two responses. Number one is this is part of the standard waiver process. I accept
responsibility.
I am guilty of these charges.
Right.
So it is a guilty plea. But the other part is that the district court's summary judgment analysis is based on testimony from Pesch and from Sherlock about what they would have done. But Amtrak does not have any evidence whatsoever as to who was the decision maker. And since neither Pesch nor Sherlock remember being involved in the decision, their testimony 5 years later about what they would have done in 2007 it certainly has no probative value, but even more importantly than that, for the purpose of assessing what was really going on here, is they didn't know that Ebersole had gotten a waiver. They didn't know that Ebersole had jumped off the train. They didn't know that Ebersole had told Smith in a recorded interview taken approximately an hour after the derailment. They didn't know that Ebersole said that the blue light was out.
Can you tell me, you had mentioned that Mr. Ebersole was disciplined for being off the train. And can you just remind me where in the record, or point to me where in the record that is, that he was actually disciplined for
that? Your Honor, it is the plaintiff's exhibit, I think number one or number two, and it's right in the first or second exhibit following the plaintiff's statement of material facts. And so that precise page is going to be, it's called Amtrak's Charging Letter to Ebersole. And it's at page 322. Ebersole's waiver is at 323. And there's attached to that a corrected version of the Amtrak charging letter to Ebersole. Amtrak's charging letter to Ebersole has two pages, and that's why the corrected version was filed. And the second page lists the specific charge against Ebersole that demonstrates that those involved knew specifically what had happened. The wording is important because the specification about the charge against Eversole for getting off the jumping off the train. It says further, this action contributed to the derailment in that you were not in the cab of the locomotive to notify your engineer.
Right, so you're on 327, is that right?
Beg pardon?
327, is that right?
327, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
And the you know, in terms of what actually happened as opposed to what Mr. Smith has said, that, you know, there's a jury question there. What we have here is a situation like, maybe I think perhaps like Parlow Cronenman or Solomon case, where the judge is making findings of fact. He says, I find it's reasonable to find Smith credible. Well, we submit that's a jury issue, that there was substantial evidence to support Smith's testimony that the blue light was properly displayed. Smith wasn't there, and it's inconsistent with whatever Saul told him. And thirdly, that it really deserved to be denied a waiver.
Mr. Carl, can you just really quickly address the spoliation issue? And, you know, what, just succinctly, what is the basis for believing that it wasn't just they have some tapes and they flush them as a routine matter, but well, that somebody actually had a duty to preserve it and didn't?
Well, Your Honor, the part of this is an element of the timeline. I mean, they take the tapes and they record the motion detector, and they record what happens in the yard, and they record what happens, you know, in order to properly investigate an accident. And the derailment was on October 20th. Edler, the union rep, asked for the video on October 26th, and it's never, I'm sorry, Edler asked for the video on October 29th, the Monday, or 9 days after the accident, and there was no dispute below as to whether or not the tapes actually existed. There's testimony in the, for example, in the Kavanaugh deposition, it's appendix pages 421 through 426 about the reason why they have these particular tapes or why they were taping it. And the whole premise of having this taping system is in order to investigate if there's an accident. And so our argument with respect to the spoliation is really twofold. And number one, if, and this goes back to the business judgment rule, if Smith was really serious about finding out whether or not the blue light was properly displayed, he would have looked at the tapes. And secondly, the fact that he didn't look at the tapes and Runkle said the tapes were destroyed certainly would support an inference by a jury that, in fact, they knew about the tapes. They
Is
knew
there
they
any testimony from Runkle or any declaration from Runkle?
He was, well, the discussions between Edler and Runkle's, and Edler includes this in his declaration.
Right, but there's nothing from Runkle's, because it seems like if you really wanted to press a spoliation issue, you would have had something from Runkle saying, tape destroyed. It's a little hearsay, right, what we have?
Your Honor, we submit specifically excluded from the hearsay rule under 801D2. And, you know, for example, the decision that Judge Kavanaugh was on, a case called English versus D.C., lays out specific requirements as to what is hearsay and what's not. And it seems that it's perhaps under Talavera and under English that it's certainly not hearsay and that we satisfy the requirements by showing that Runkles could make this statement within the scope of his employment, that it was related to his duties. Runkle was the guy in charge of the room where they kept the video equipment. And he doesn't have to show, that the plaintiff does not have to show that Runkles was involved in any way in the employment decision. But where Amtrak comes in and says, well, you know, we've got this business judgment rule, and we did this thorough investigation, it's one of more than a half a dozen pieces of evidence showing that that's not true, that there was no serious investigation, that Smith concealed material information. And if you really wanted to know whether the light was on, instead of going to the scene of the derailment and looking at the scene of the derailment when he wasn't there at the time, certainly does not fulfill the duty of creating or doing a thorough investigation, if he wanted to know the answer is no, then the same is true. I believe with the video,
okay,
with the audio
right,
tapes as well.
You're well over your time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Andrew Sackler here on behalf of Amtrak. I want to take you back. In October of 2007, Mr. Burley was alone on an engine. He alone pushed that engine forward over an applied derail and derailed his train. And Amtrak conducted a full and thorough investigation. And my colleague on the other side is pointing to Smith and attempting to create the impression that Mr. Smith was the sole investigation of this derailment. But that is absolutely not true. According to Mr. Burley's collective bargaining agreement, Amtrak had to offer him a full evidentiary hearing, something that amounted to essentially a bench trial before a neutral hearing officer who was not a member of Amtrak's transportation department. And at that hearing, Mr. Burley was represented by his union. He was able to testify in his own behalf. He was able to present whatever evidence he liked. He was able to cross-examine Amtrak's witnesses. And the hearing officer, examining all of the evidence, found that Mr. Burley was responsible for the derailment and crossed the blue signal, and by doing so, violated one of the most egregious rules that an engineer can violate.
But Mr. Sackleris, didn't the hearing officer rely substantially on Smith's report at the time? Wasn't that the main, really significant piece of evidence in that hearing?
Your Honor, we will not deny that Mr. Smith was a significant witness in the hearing. But there were many witnesses, including Mr. Burley himself.
His report doesn't even talk about Ebersole's involvement, Smith's report. So it's I mean, there are some gaps that your opposing counsel has pointed to, that Smith is giving a report, and it's not complete. He's not doing the diligence that one would expect to do if one really wanted to get to the bottom of things. He didn't look at the tape. He gives a report that doesn't explain that. Ebersole was supposed to be on the front of the engine, and he jumped off without saying anything, and this is pretty mitigating for Mr. Burley, but it's not in that report.
Well, Your Honor, and I would agree with you, if this one-page document that's about seven sentences long were in fact the investigation, but there was an entire hearing that included Mr. Ebersole was a witness, Mr. Burley was a witness, Mr. Smith was a witness, and Mr. Burley's union rep was able to cross-examine all of these people. So all of these supposed mitigating facts, where Ebersole was at the time, where Mr. Burley was at the time, the fact that Mr. Burley couldn't see the derail, all of this evidence about sort of what lights were blinking and what lights were not blinking, all of this was covered in the hearing. Because it wasn't Mr. Smith's job to perform the investigation. That was the role of the hearing officer. Amtrak could not discipline Mr. Burley based on Mr. Smith's one-page report alone. We submit that there was a 180-page transcript with exhibits and documents, cross-examination. That, in fact, was the investigation here. And I think, more importantly, this is a race discrimination case. This is not an arbitration over whether Mr. Burley did, in fact, derail the engine. And largely, the facts of that, even the derailment, are not necessarily in dispute. There's no dispute that Mr. Burley's 120-ton train was off the tracks. And there's no dispute that Mr. Ebersole was not on the train at the time of the derailment. And there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Ebersole was required to be on the train. In fact,
I thought he was required to be on the train. You dispute that Amtrak doesn't require the conductor to be on the train.
No, Your Honor. In fact, engineers conductors are frequently not on the train.
On the train or in a place where he's in the line of sight and can warn the engineer if they're coming up on a blue signal?
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting that you mention that, because the very rule that requires someone to be in the line of sight also requires an engineer, if they don't have visual contact with the person that's supposed to be guiding them, they're not permitted to travel forward.
Well, they're either supposed to be on the engine, in which case I think they wouldn't be visible, or be off and in the line of sight. Is that not right?
Well, I don't think the record supports that is a hard and fast requirement, because there are frequently...
And in fact, I think I was pointing to a place in the record where Ebersole was disciplined because he wasn't where he was supposed to be. And you're saying that Amtrak doesn't require that, but they disciplined him anyway?
Well, the record isn't clear as to whether he was actually required to be there, but you are absolutely right that he did receive discipline. But
for not being where he was supposed to be at the time of the derailment.
That does appear to be why he was disciplined. But, Your Honor, it's undisputed that Mr. Burley and Mr. Burley alone was the only person who could have pushed that train forward. And again, my point here is that this is not what is before the court and what would be before the jury is not whether Amtrak was right or wrong in this decision.
I understand that. It's a racial discrimination case, and he has to show that the reason that he was treated differently and not given a waiver and discharge was because of his race, but he's trying to rely on circumstantial evidence. What about the spoliation issue? What is the records retention or video policy that Amtrak employs in this yard? Why was that video, A, not consulted, and B, destroyed?
Well, Your Honor, first and foremost, there is absolutely no record evidence that there was ever a videotape of this. There was no mention of a videotape in this case until we received the other side's opposition to our summary judgment. And so,
didn't someone testify in the deposition that it was destroyed?
No, Your Honor. The only mention of a video being destroyed came in Carl Edler's declaration. Now, he provides his declaration 5 years later. He doesn't give any detail that would indicate that there ever was a video.
What about Runkel? Isn't Runkel a guy who runs the video system?
He says Runkel destroyed it.
Your Honor, I don't believe
he said that. Didn't he tell that he told the union? Oh, this is the union representative's affidavit, right?
Correct.
He was told by Runkel, right, that Amtrak had erased the tape.
He claimed that he was told by Runkel that the tape was destroyed. I don't think Runkel said that he personally destroyed that tape.
No, I said that it was destroyed. I didn't say that. He says he used the passive, was destroyed, was erased.
That does appear in Mr. Edler's declaration. Now, nobody has ever testified whether there was, in fact, a video or was not a video. And I think, as Your Honor mentioned.
Do you know whether there was?
I'm sorry?
Do you know whether there was or wasn't?
I do not.
Know. You just don't know?
No, I just do not know. And frankly, even if there were, appellant's claim is that Mr. Smith somehow ignored this video. And there's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Smith was aware of the video, had access to a video, and purposely decided not to review the video. But most importantly, again, this is a race discrimination case. So he would have to present some evidence that whether Mr. Smith was right or wrong, sloppy or thorough, that his decision was guided by racial animus. And there's just absolutely no evidence of that on the record.
Well, can he rely on the fact that Amtrak can't seem to remember anything about this case?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Couldn't he rely on the fact that Amtrak employees can't seem to remember anything about this case? Like, was there a video? Who was involved in the Ebersol waiver? Right?
No, respectfully, Your Honor. No. I would disagree with that because there has to be actual evidence of race discrimination. Mm-hmm. And this court in Brady.
No, there doesn't. That's not what the law is. You don't have to have actual. You can rely on circumstantial evidence. That's what Brady's all about.
With respect, Your Honor, I think what Brady says is that the appellant here cannot just simply survive summary judgment by saying, well, I happen to disagree with the overall program.
You're totally right about that, but can't you rely on, can't you draw inferences from a defendant's inability to remember key facts about a case?
No, Your Honor.
No?
Respectfully, I believe you cannot. You cannot, the jury cannot make the logical connection between somebody's inability to remember something 5 years after it occurred and race discrimination. And again, he has chosen to focus this case on Mr. Smith. And so whether Mr. Pesch or Mr. Sherlock can remember what occurred, whether there was a videotape or not, none of this is any evidence of race discrimination whatsoever.
If Pesch and Sherlock think they probably would have been the person to be involved in Ebersol's waiver, aren't they, by the same token, probably the people that made the decision on Burley's waiver?
Your Honor, I think you actually had the facts backwards, but the answer to that is no. There is absolutely no evidence that they would have been involved in Mr. Ebersol's waiver. Again, we have very different situations. We're talking about a derailment. In that derailment, it was undisputed that Mr. Burley and Mr. Burley alone was on the engine. And so Mr. Pesch and Mr. Sherlock believe that one of the two of them would have been involved. And in fact, Mr. Pesch in his deposition said, given the nature of this case, I would have been at least involved in that decision. But whether Mr. Pesch and Mr. Sherlock made the right decision or the wrong decision about Mr. Burley's waiver, it's undisputed in the record that neither of those gentlemen knew Mr. Burley's race. So even if they were wrong, even if they overreacted here, again, this is a race discrimination claim. And so the very fact that they don't know Mr. Burley's race would preclude any reasonable jury from finding that they denied him a waiver because of his race. And now, the appellant attempts to sort of get around that, what we would submit as a fact that is fatal to his case, by saying, well, it was Mr. Smith who made these decisions. But I think, as Your Honor correctly noted, there's no record in the evidence that Mr. Smith had any involvement in the waiver. In fact, the only record evidence is that Mr. Smith denied that he was involved. And in fact, at his deposition, he was never even asked if he was involved in Mr. Ebersol's waiver. So, you know, whether or not it was fair or just that Amtrak denied Mr. Burley's waiver, there's simply no evidence on the record that would show that it's discrimination. Now, because it's undisputed that Mr. Pesch was the person who terminated Mr. Burley, and it's undisputed that Mr. Pesch did not know Mr. Burley's race at the time he made that termination decision, appellant is trying to make this into a cat's paw case. And we would submit that he's doing so is a misapplication of the Supreme Court's decision in Staub versus Proctor Hospital. And that case is readily distinguishable from this case, because in Staub, which is a USERRA case, there was direct evidence that the so-called real decision maker, not the de facto decision maker that the hospital was trying to rely on, but the, quote, real decision maker, had actually evidenced some animus towards Mr. Staub's military service. In this case, the appellant argues that Mr. Smith was the, quote, real decision maker. And there, again, absolutely no evidence, no statements by Mr. Smith, no conduct by Mr. Smith, nothing that any reasonable jury could find that Mr. Smith acted with discriminatory animus. So whether Mr. Smith was right, whether Mr. Smith was wrong, whether his investigation was sloppy, whether he should have reviewed a videotape or not, the question is, could a reasonable jury find that he was motivated by racial animus? And we respectfully submit the answer to that is no. Now, my colleague on the other side discussed sort of questioning Amtrak's business judgment, and that's exactly what this case is really about. Because as this case in Brady held, and in Fishbach and many others, it's not the role of the federal judiciary to stand as a super personnel department, in the words of this court, to micromanage everyday employment decisions. And so if he's going to challenge Amtrak's business judgment, he bears the very heavy burden of saying that Amtrak's decision was based on errors that were too obvious to be unintentional. Looking at the undisputed facts in this case, he has to demonstrate that Amtrak's decision that Mr. Burley was culpable and responsible for derailing that engine was either not honestly held or unreasonable. Now, he doesn't allege that that decision was not honest.
Well, those cases articulate the similarly situated employee being treated differently as a way to show pretext, and that seems to be what they're really resting a lot of their case on here. So I take your point as to the broader issue, but they do seem to be trying to fit their case within that Ebersol was similarly situated and got less severe sanctions. So, I mean, that seems to be what the case boils down to, at least as the plaintiff has portrayed it here.
And certainly, let me address the similarly situated aspect of this case. So, again, because this court can't sit as a super personnel department, the two individuals need to be similarly situated in all material respects, which this court has interpreted it to mean they need to be nearly identical in all relevant aspects of their employment. The focus of his argument is that Amtrak somehow treated Mr. Burley and Mr. Ebersol differently with respect to the derailment. And so we pose that there are two major reasons why Mr. Ebersol is not similarly situated. First and foremost, this is a train derailment, and it's undisputed that Mr. Ebersol was not on the train at the time. There's no dispute that Mr. Burley was the only person who physically moved that train.
Under Amtrak rules, isn't the conductor ultimately responsible for the train?
Your Honor, the conductor is ultimately responsible for the train when he is on the train. But it's undisputed that Mr. Burley was the one that was solely responsible, given that Mr. Ebersol was not on the train. But if I could sort of address the second
point. Yeah, what's your second point? Is it that there's no evidence that Smith was involved in Ebersol's discipline?
You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
That was a question. I didn't say he wasn't. I asked you whether that is that your second argument.
That is our second argument. Yeah. So no reasonable jury could find that Mr. Burley was treated differently than Mr. Ebersol because of his race if it was not, in fact, the same person who made those two decisions. And as we've noted, there's absolutely no evidence on the record that would indicate that Mr. Smith.
But that's because Amtrak can't remember, has no recollection of who did it.
Well,
that's why I asked you the question about, you know, I mean, one of the witnesses testified that the waiver decisions were normally made by, what is it, the assistant superintendent or someone above. Smith is an assistant superintendent. Amtrak can't remember who did it. Why can't the jury infer from Amtrak's inability to remember that maybe it was Smith?
Because, Your Honor, that would be pure speculation. Because the only record evidence here is that Mr. Smith said he didn't make the decision.
But Amtrak has failed to show, I mean, Amtrak has the ability to tell us who was involved, doesn't it?
I have sort of two responses to that, yeah. Your Honor. First and foremost, I don't think Amtrak bears the burden here.
Mm-hmm.
Because under the sort of burden-shifting framework, Amtrak's burden was to come up with...
So if there's a rule that if there's a rule that decisions are made by either A or B, that's the rule. Okay, A is one of the people, and we don't know whether B did it. And the defendant says, well, we don't remember who did it. Why can't the jury infer that, well, they're the defendant, this pretext?
Well, first, Your Honor, you're speaking about the testimony of Zach Pinkman.
No, I'm talking about Smith, yeah. He said it's either made by the assistant superintendent or someone above. Smith was the assistant superintendent, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Smith.
And Amtrak can't remember. That's all we've got.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence on the record is that the decision...
Smith is clearly one of the people who could have made the decision, and it sort of makes sense that, you know, he was involved in the Burley one. Why wouldn't he be involved in this one?
Well, Your Honor, there's absolutely no evidence that Mr. Smith was involved in the Burley one or the Ebersole one.
This is an employer, a common employer with common, you know, priorities and sense of the importance. I mean, you show a great amount of indignation about the seriousness of this particular event. But, you know, the appellant in the brief talks about Caucasian engineers speeding when his locomotive collided with a stop train for $36,000 of damage, and as he gets suspended for 5 days. And, you know, another one who fails a drug test showing cocaine in his urine, and, you know, his train collides with another train, and he gets later disciplined. I mean, there is a pattern where you think at some level there these do become relevant. You know, this is out of line with what has been done by a number of different supervisors in a number of different engineer situations with serious damage to property.
Well, with respect, Your Honor,
danger to the individuals.
I'd like to first address the drug case. Drugs are handled in a very specific way, and this isn't on the record, but drugs are handled in a very specific way under the collective bargaining agreement. So it's almost impossible to compare a drug case to another case. But this involves questions of whether other white engineers can be adequate comparators. But the record evidence on each one of those particular instances is that those individuals were given waivers by either Mr. Sherlock or Mr. Pesch. But it's undisputed, even if those people were adequate comparators, it's undisputed that neither Pesch nor Sherlock knew Mr. Burley's race. And so even if Mr. Burley could meet the technical requirements for a comparator analysis, no reasonable jury could find that those individuals were treated more favorably than Mr. Burley because of Mr. Burley's race, because it's undisputed that Mr. Pesch and Mr. Sherlock did not know Mr. Burley's race at the time that they made any decision. And, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time.
Else?
So unless there are any additional questions.
No, we have no other questions. I think, did the counsel have any time left?
Thank you.
Okay, you can take 2 minutes if you'd like.
Mr. Carl, is there any evidence in the record that Smith was aware that Mr. Ebersole was not on the engine at the time that this accident occurred, at the initial time that he made his report?
Yes, there was. Number one, there's the disciplinary report that I cited earlier that was given to Ebersole that says you're being charged with jumping off the engine. Secondly, Burley told him. And thirdly, there's an interview with the with Ebersole that was conducted approximately an hour after the derailment.
Did Smith appreciate that Ebersole had never told Burley that he got off? I mean, it seems like the facts, as Ebersole agrees them to be later, render Burley to be not culpable, but just kind of snookered. It's not clear that Smith appreciated that.
Yes, that's what Mr. Burley told him. But to go back to the taping system, this is on page 422 of the appendix.
Did Smith know, because you're putting a lot on Smith, did he know that Burley was unaware that Ebersole had gotten off? Because there's a different level of care. If you know you're the only person driving, then you've got to take a different level of care if you think your teammate is on there. And I guess since this all gets down to Smith's intent, you need to show that Smith knew that but still treated Burley harshly. What points to Smith that Burley was unaware?
Yes, he told him. Burley told Smith.
Burley told Smith right away?
Yes.
And he testifies that, and where's that?
Yes.
Where should I look in the record for that?
I'll find out, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay.
With respect to the question about the taping system, I don't want to belabor this, but this is Bernard Campbell's deposition. Yeah. Campbell was one of the people on the investigation committee. On page 422 of the appendix, he says Dave Smith would definitely have looked at the tapes.
Okay.
With respect to the question about what's Smith's tie-in here, Tingley says he took the request to Smith. Adler, the union rep, says he talked to Smith about the waiver. So for Smith to say he doesn't remember is a sort of testimony that, when it's considered with all the other testimony, the jury certainly might not believe. From the point of view of what happened in the accident, what happened in the derailment.
Could you finish up your sentence?
Okay. Direct evidence is not required. There's a dispute of fact as to what really happened. And this court's decision in Primus versus D.C. is that's why you have a jury to sort all this out.
Okay. Thank you. Case is submitted. Thank you.